This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are again. It is once again time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com. Please send questions because they are grist for the mill for this weekly broadcast. With me today is our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mutin, who I work with side by side at my practice in Manhattan, NYC. So how are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Oh, very good. Before we get into our questions, actually, mm-hmm. It was you that shared with me in the office a very interesting article. You receive a journal from your professional society, which is whatever journal used to be called JADA, Journal of the American Dietetics Association. They changed the name,
I think. Yes, it's the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
Well, you can't make a word out of that. JADA sounds better.
No. But okay, so JADA sounds better.
Right.
So now it's JAND. Oh, J-A-N-D, JAND.
That doesn't resonate
as much.
Is what
it is.
Anyway, so...
Right.
So, you know, that is an interesting journal because they actually have some pretty decent articles in there from time mm-hmm. to time. It's not all just about mm-hmm. new ways of serving Jell-O, you know, which is kind of that the bad connotation associated with mainstream conventional RDs. you know, I don't again.
Where's my Ensure?
Yeah, exactly. So, right. and unfortunately, in the past, many of the articles in there have been underwritten and co-sponsored by, in some cases, pharmaceutical companies, in some cases, the dairy industry, in some cases, the wheat industry, or
sure.
alternatively, the meat board. You know, everybody wants to get their dibs in there because they know that there's a whole phalanx of professional nutritionists out there who are going to purvey their message to the populace.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. You know, I turn a jaundiced eye sometimes towards that journal. You know, not to impugn the wonderful RDs out there in our listening audience who are incorporating progressive notions about nutrition and at least giving full consideration to dietary supplements, which in the past has been frowned upon by the professional society. But now more and more, I think they're integrating. You shared an article with me, very interesting article.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall the title of it? It was something to the effect... Go ahead.
Yes. It's orthorexia nervosa and eating disorder symptoms in registered dietitian nutritionists in the United States.
Uh-huh.
You know, besides the change from JADA...
So another way to frame this discussion is, does your nutrition health professional suffer from an eating disorder?
Yes.
That's really a way to frame this discussion because, you know, mm-hmm. just like in psychiatry, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. people who have some questionable mental status, you know, they want to study psychology
right.
and, you know, get into that field. And
What's the quote? It's physician, heal thyself.
Yeah, exactly. But
right?
you know, or they're
does
among
dietitian heal yourself?
It's a little bit like having a fireman who's an arsonist, you know, a closet arsonist. You know,
oh, well, so. That was the movie Backdraft, if you remember.
Oh, okay.
There was an arsonist in the fire department.
So life imitates art.
I just gave it away.
Life.
All right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So tell us about that article mm-hmm. because first of all, let's define the term orthorexia nervosa, which
yes.
was coined by a good colleague mm-hmm. of mine back in I think it was way back in the 80s. I've known this term for a long time.
Yes. orthorexia nervosa is a disorder, is an eating disorder of, you know, that encompasses being obsessed with correct eating all the time, mm-hmm. healthy eating, correct eating all the time, ortho and, meaning correct.
And correct, yeah, so. And the root of the word ortho, I guess, is a Greek word. And we sometimes talk about orthomolecular medicine, which means medicine that sort of straightens things out with nutritional supplements. You can straighten out, like psychiatric conditions can be modified with nutrients. But so orthorexia, and it borrows from the term anorexia. It's like, it's not like you're starving yourself, but you're overly preoccupied on a day-to-day basis with every morsel of food you put in your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, in our profession, maybe, just like with many of our patients and clients, when we have to have them on a very restricted diet for, say, a medical condition or some symptoms that they're experiencing in order to have them abated, oftentimes the patient can start to feel like they're backed into a corner in terms of what's left to eat. These are the only foods I can eat. If I stray, what if my symptoms come back or something like that? So there becomes then an obsession or a food phobia all about eating the right food all the time without any straying at all. Anyway, this particular article took a sample of 2,500 RDNs. Now, RD, this language is becoming RDN, not just registered dietitian, but registered dietitian nutritionists. Okay. There's been an outcry amongst registered dietitians about saying, no, I'm a nutritionist. Mm-hmm. Don't just call me a dietitian. Mm-hmm. I'm a nutritionist too. So RD is changing to RDA, RDN.
So I have to change the way I introduce you. I introduce you as Layla Mutin, RDMA.
No, that's fine. That's fine with me. It's MS, by the way.
MS, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's RD. It's fine with me. I don't have a problem being called a dietitian. I am a dietitian.
Okay.
So, and I'm a nutritionist. I am both. Therefore.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this particular study, they looked at a sample of 2,500 registered dietitian nutritionists. They were invited to complete surveys. And of them, 636 responses were received, and they basically wanted to see scores on an orthorexia nervosa questionnaire, an eating disorder examination questionnaire, to determine the prevalence of either of those, ON or ED, in our profession.
Mm-hmm.
So they took a look at that, and what they found was that about 49.5% were at risk for orthorexia nervosa. This is of the 636
that responded.
Virtually half. Yeah, half of that. And scores on the eating disorder questionnaire suggested that 12.9% were at risk for an eating disorder.
A frank eating disorder, which would include like starving yourself.
Like
or
anorexia,
binging,
anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, any of those.
Putting your finger in your throat
or
to
even
throw
binge
up,
eating.
You know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And about 8.2% of the RDNs were self-disclosing treatment for an eating disorder.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the practical consequence for the patient, you know, it with this state of affairs?
Exactly. So it's like what you mentioned about the psychiatrist or psychologist who may be crazy. Do they have any business treating another crazy person with mental illness?
Crazy is a relative term, and orthorexia nervosa is, you know, like one man's orthorexia nervosa might be another person's stringent dietary program, which might actually help some people who really require structured program, shall we say, and very strong recommendations get well. So,
For example, somebody with celiac disease.
Yeah.
They must adhere. Avoid gluten.
Yeah. So it's good to be a little orthorexic when it comes to a disease that has some really severe consequences if you're not careful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I even remember, you know, back when I was an undergrad, I know two of the women, at least in my class, had either an eating disorder or had disordered eating. One literally didn't take off her coat the entire time because she was that thin and was hiding it. And you know, others confided in me that they don't eat more than 600 calories a day. This is an eating disorder.
Yeah. What I like about you, and I've gotten to know you personally as well as professionally, is that you are very committed to healthy eating. On the other hand, you have sort of a reasonable approach to this in your personal lifestyle. And I think occasionally if the opportunity presents itself, rather than get yourself tied up in a knot, you might imbibe something that's a little off your diet here and there. And,
that's
to the good.
And I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the other thing, in getting back to correct eating, I do because I can, within limits, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got their limits. I do because I can, but if I had celiac disease,
right.
I'm not going to go eat gluten just because it's there.
If you had type 2 diabetes, you might require a very stringent program until your blood sugar is controlled. Or perhaps,
for
example, put our patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease on a very strict diet. And, their success really depends on their very, very careful compliance. So, for example, I have a lady who I just called up yesterday because I got her stool test. And there's a marker in the stool that actually determines whether one has active colitis. And this is a lady I've been working with for a couple of years. She's now pregnant. And she is on minimal medication. She's only on, I think, mesalamine, which is a very light medication. And her, and when she came in, she was having a lot of trouble. Her ulcerative colitis, she claims that she didn't have any symptoms at all. So I said, let's do a stool test just to make sure there's not signs of inflammation. We did a stool test, and lo and behold, she has it fully controlled. And I said, well, are you sticking to the diet? And she said, yeah. And this really takes some character and some determination to stick to a diet. But she knows that that's the pathway to salvation. And she really doesn't want to be on heavy-duty medications while she's nursing her baby. So she's highly motivated to stick to the diet. I mean, maybe she's a little orthorexic, but that can be good under the circumstances.
It can be good, and we can't call it orthorexia. We can't call that an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
This is a highly, highly medical. This is a therapeutic diet at its best. It's medical nutrition therapy at its best. We are medical nutrition therapists. This is what this is about.
Yeah.
And there are certain diets that we do have to be fanatical about. Specific carbohydrate diet is one, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The other one is the gluten-free diet for celiac disease.
Yeah.
There may be more out there, or anybody with a severe allergy that's causing anaphylaxis.
I think we should apply the definition
of peanut allergy or something.
Exactly. I think we should apply the definition of an addiction. Because this is a form of an addiction, and an addictive behavior, whether it be, extreme dieting, binging, anorexia, or in other realms like substance abuse, sexual abuse, like Harvey Weinstein obviously falls into that category. When it becomes destructive to yourself or others, is when you cross the line. And so, I would sort of paraphrase a term that was once very much maligned, quote from an old presidential candidate, long deceased politician, Barry Goldwater, who in the 1960s ran against Lyndon Johnson. And he said, quote, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And everybody got the impression that this guy's nuts. He's an extremist. But I would paraphrase that, regardless. I'm not commenting on the political aspects of that. I would say extremism in the defense of health is no vice as long as it is beneficial for you and not destructive and not driving everybody in your circle crazy. And, or you could, as a professional, health professional, you could inflict damage on others by imposing an overly restrictive diet regimen on people who don't require it and maybe make them nutsy about food when food is, is something that you shouldn't be obsessing about 24/7.
Exactly. And there's a particular demographic that we have to be very careful with. I'm always wary of the parent who comes to me with their 16-year-old daughter saying, does my daughter need a detox? No, she is 16.
Yeah.
Look at any proper detox manual. You should be over the age of 18. You should not be pregnant. You should not have kidney disease, liver disease. Why does your 16-year-old need a detox? She's a perfectly healthy 16-year-old. So we have to be careful with also what's being imposed. It's the whole world of eating disorders is frankly fascinating to me. And many of my clients who are overweight, obese, particularly women, I find when I've met their mother or when they bring their mother to me, is the skinny, coffee drinking, cigarette smoking, instead of having a meal, skinny person, fat phobic, all of that. And what I'm seeing in front of me is now your 4-year-old child has rebelled.
Yeah, at some
subconscious level.
And
she's eating anything
level.
She wants. And exactly. Yeah. Because of that early deprivation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's
a boomerang effect. All right, enough said.
Right.
We want to get to questions. And I mean, it's an important topic.
That's a whole podcast right there.
Right, right. No, good stuff. So let's tackle some of the questions that we have before us today.
Okay, we have an email from Susan. Susan asks, what is your opinion of a zinc challenge, also known as a zinc tally test, to determine a person's need for zinc supplementation?
Okay.
So apparently there's this challenge where using about a half a teaspoon of preferably liquid zinc, a form of liquid zinc, and what happens is you fall into some categories. If you take that half a teaspoon of liquid zinc and it tastes like nothing to you, like water, you need some zinc. And at the other, it may mean a deficiency of zinc in that person. Now, on the other hand, if they take this challenge and they're at the other extreme, they go, oh, the terrible, you know, look on their face, and it tastes like metal and it's horrible, and they can't drink away the taste.
It's like putting a nickel in your mouth or something like that, you know.
So what do you think, Dr. Hoffman?
This is interesting because this is something that we used quite a lot in the 80s and in the early 90s. It was kind of the gold standard, and they would actually sell zinc tolerance kits. There's a product called Zinc Tally, and what you would do is you put a few drops in the patient's tongue, and then if the patient tasted nothing, you would say they were zinc deficient, and if they said yuck, then they were zinc sufficient. So I just pulled up a study from the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, 2012. So it's actually not from a journal. It's a journal hospitable to vitamins and supplements. And what they did is they did a study of the studies on this. And they're not many. There were only three that seemed to meet the criteria for inclusion. And this is a mini meta-analysis. And what they found was that there was no significant correlation between the results of the zinc tally and levels of zinc as measured in the white blood cells. So the conclusion is, to date, there are no tests that are both sensitive and specific that accurately assess marginal zinc status in humans. And it point out also that blood tests actually are not that deadly accurate either. I mean, blood tests can spot major serious deficiencies, but you could actually spot such a deficiency just from a diet history. You know, if you sit with a patient and you see that they're just eating junk food, they may not have adequate zinc and they're not taking any supplements. Symptoms would be dry skin, low immunity. Many elderly patients, I think, could benefit from some zinc. Because
white
of poor
spots.
Diets, poor absorption. But white spots on the fingernails may be a sign
fingernails.
Of that. Again, that's not a very,
among other things, but it may be,
That there, it's not a specific sign of that because it could be from trauma to the nails. So, you know, that's the problem, I got to say.
Interesting.
It's not, it's not that gospel.
So best is the blood test, pretty much.
Blood test, but also you have a simple dietary history. And, you know, if in doubt, take 30 milligrams of supplemental zinc along with a little bit of copper in about a, you know, we generally do about a, eight
it's
to
like
one
a
ratio.
15 milligram zinc to about 1 or 2 milligrams copper.
Correct.
Typically, something like that.
Because actually, this is something that is in the literature. It's very interesting. There's an article that I recall in the New England Journal of Medicine, which I still subscribe to because, I mean, there's so many articles about these great new drugs and, you know, okay, I need to know about that, but it doesn't interest me that much. But there's a very interesting article about a patient who came in who was like really sick with all these mysterious symptoms. And it turns out that the patient had been taking very high dose zinc I think something in the realm of like 200 to 400 milligrams of zinc every day without any copper.
Wow.
And what the patient had, and all they described, all these weird symptoms, was an actual copper deficiency, because too much zinc drives out copper. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a certain disease where you have excess copper accumulation. It's called Wilson's disease. The treatment mm-hmm. is to give a lot of zinc to drive the copper out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worthwhile taking a little copper when you're taking high-dose zinc. Make sure that your multi has some, or what are dietary sources of copper? I think nuts and shellfish offer copper.
Meat, shellfish, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All of those, egg yolks as well.
Suck on a penny.
You know,
if they're still made with copper. I don't think they're made with copper anymore because copper is so valuable.
Yeah. Dark meat poultry, much more in the dark meat where we get the zinc and the selenium and the iron rather than just the chicken breast. The dark meat is better.
Okay.
Oftentimes.
I like the tenders. I like the tenders, so that works.
Yeah.
I prefer the tenders actually to the breast that, you know, some people.
Oh, yeah, I do too. I love the dark meat. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Susan, thank you for your question.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's put another question in for this segment.
We have a question from Martin. My lab report creatinine level was 1.52.
Mm.
Any vitamins you could recommend to lower it? Okay. First of all, this is a consult.
Yeah, it's a real essay question.
It really is, yeah. It's not just a matter of my creatinine is high, what can I take to lower it? The question is, why is it high?
Right.
Why is it high? What's going on?
And so let's look at some of the possible reasons. And I think we might split this mm-hmm. question because it's going to take some time to weigh in on, you know, the whys and the wherefores, number one. Number two, we can chunk this question into three parts. One is, why might you have it and what could you do to alleviate that? So the second part would be, what sort of diet is optimal for preventing progression of higher creatinine? Mm-hmm. By the way, high creatinine is a sign that your kidneys are beginning to fail. Mm-hmm. And finally, what supplements can be taken and what supplements should not be taken? Because there are certain supplements that should be avoided if you have limited kidney function. So let's start with the whys and the wherefores. What are some of the reasons why someone might be progressing towards
renal
failure.
Compromise. Yeah, now, renal compromise. Here are a few reasons. Well, one of them is high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
High blood pressure will definitely impact the kidneys. Elevated blood sugar, as in diabetes.
Yep.
Diabetes can compromise. Elevated blood sugar is associated with diabetes, can compromise renal functions.
Mm-hmm.
Certain medications and NSAIDs. If
yes.
you're a regular user of Aleve, ibuprofen, you know, the brand names Motrin or Advil,
mm-hmm.
aspirin, any of those, they have long-term impact on the kidneys.
They
and
do.
Now lately, PPIs.
Yeah, that's a new revelation
mm-hmm.
is that PPIs
proton
may be associated
with
these, you know, the Prilosec, Nexium, and so
those drugs for GERD,
Mm-hmm.
So, and other certain medications.
Sure.
And those would be the reasons, actually, for mm-hmm. why a creatinine would be high.
There's some people who have an autoimmune disease, you know, that can cause the kidneys mm-hmm. to fail, glomerulonephritis. It's not uncommon in children, less common in older adults, but there are certain diseases that mm-hmm. cause damage to the kidneys. So, all right.
Polycystic kidney disease is another one,
which is a hereditary condition, and it's sort of mm-hmm. an inexorable process by which the kidney gets filled up with more and more cysts and then mm-hmm. Loses its capacity to filter. And so the creatinine and BUN are blood tests that indicate kidney function. And we generally consider a good creatinine as 1.4 or 1.5 or less. And in this case, the creatinine is 1.52. So just on the verge of being too high. So in a patient like this, we would monitor them carefully to mm-hmm. see if over time the creatinine is creeping higher. When the creatinine starts to go up to like 2, 3, 4, this reaches sort of a tipping point where it's really hard to come back from that. We have a couple of patients who are sort of suspended on the precipice of needing dialysis. At a certain point, a decision is made because it looks like the kidneys are going to fail. and they're not properly filtering. And people who have a high creatinine often have a high BUN, which makes them kind of miserable. They have what's called uremia, which means toxic waste products accumulate. And they may suffer from just feel lousy, sort of toxic, and sometimes have bodily itch associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then it's kind of hard to bring them back from that point.
Yeah.
Sort of a critical momentum towards kidney failure and the requirement for dialysis. So that being said, this is a good question. I think let's get into part two, which is the diet, and part three, which is what supplements are beneficial. In part two of today's podcast, because we divide our podcast into two parts, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mutin. And Layla can be seen also at our practice in Manhattan. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.